وَيَسْتَفْتُونَكَ فِي النِّسَاءِ قُلِ اللَّهُ يُفْتِيكُمْ فِيهِنَّ وَمَا يُتْلَى عَلَيْكُمْ فِي الْكِتَابِ فِي يَتَامَى النِّسَاءِ فِي يَتَامَى النِّسَاءِ اللَّاتِي لَا تُؤْتُونَهُنَّ مَا كُتِبَ لَهُنَّ وَتَرْغَبُونَ أَن تَنكِحُوهُنَّ وَالْمُسْتَضْعَفِينَ مِنَ الْوِلْدَانِ وَأَن تَقُومُوا لِلْيَتَامَى بِالْقِسْطِ وَمَا تَفْعَلُوا مِنْ خَيْرٍ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ كَانَ بِهِ عَلِيمًا.
They ask you to pronounce laws concerning women. Say, Allah pronounces to you concerning them and reminds you of the injunctions which were recited to you in the book about female orphans whom you do not give what has been ordained for them and whom you wish to marry out of greed, and the commandments relating to the children who are weak and helpless. Allah directs you to treat the orphans with justice. Allah is well aware of whatever good you do. They ask you to pronounce laws concerning women. The actual query about women is not spelled out directly. The judgment pronounced a little later on in response to that query, however, makes it abundantly clear what the query was. Say, Allah pronounces to you concerning them. This is not a response to the query itself. Before attending to this, God once again emphasizes that people should implement His directives regarding orphans in general, and orphan girls in particular, as mentioned at the beginning of this surah. This shows the importance of the rights of orphans in the sight of God. The protection of their rights, as we have pointed out, had already been stressed forcefully. But that was not deemed sufficient. Hence, when problems of family life came up for discussion, the question of the well-being of orphans automatically arose even before answering the questions people raised. About female orphans, whom you do not give what has been ordained for them. This alludes to verse 3 of this surah. And if you fear that you might not treat the orphans justly, then marry the women that seem good to you, and whom you wish to marry out of greed. The words of the text, وَتَرْغَبُونَ أَن تَنْكِهُوهُنَّ, may be interpreted as, whom you wish to marry out of greed, and also, whom you do not wish to marry. In explanation of this verse, Aisha states that in those days, guardians of orphans who had any significant inheritance from their parents used to perpetrate many wrongs on their wards. If the girl was both rich and good-looking, the guardian desired to marry her and exploit both her attractiveness and wealth without either having to make the bridal due, mehr, or even having to undertake her maintenance. If the girl was ugly, the guardian would neither marry her nor allow her to get married, for she might thus get a husband who would support her claim for her legitimate rights. And the commandments relating to the children who are weak and helpless. The reference here is to the injunctions regarding the protection of the rights of orphans at the beginning of the surah.
وَإِنْ امْرَأَةٌ خَافَتْ مِنْ بَعْلِهَا نُشُوزًا أَوْ إِعْرَاضًا فَلَا جُنَاحَ عَلَيْهِمَا أَنْ يُصْلِحَا بَيْنَهُمَا صُلْحًا وَالصُّلْحُ خَيْرٌ وَأُحْضِرَتِ الْأَنْفُسُ الشُّحَّ وَإِن تُحْسِنُوا وَتَتَّقُوا فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ كَانَ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ خَبِيرًا.
If a woman fears either ill-treatment or aversion from her husband, it is not wrong for the husband and wife to bring about reconciliation among themselves by compromising on their rights, for settlement is better. Man's soul is always prone to selfishness, but if you do good and are God-fearing, then surely Allah is aware of the things you do. If the actual response to the query begins here, in order to appreciate the response fully, one would do well to consider the query itself. In the days of ignorance, a man was free to marry an unlimited number of women who had virtually no rights. When the preliminary verses of the present surah were revealed, this freedom was circumscribed in two ways. First, the maximum number of wives was fixed at 4. Second, justice, that is equal treatment of wives, was laid down as a necessary condition for marrying more than one. This gives rise to the question whether a person is obligated by Islam to feel equally towards each of his wives, to love each to an equal degree, and treat them equally even in respect of sexual relationship. Such questions are especially relevant with regard to a husband, one of whose wives might be, say, afflicted with either sterility, permanent sickness, or who is incapable of sexual intercourse. Does justice demand that if he fails to live up to the standards of equality mentioned above, that he should renounce his first wife in order to marry the second? Moreover, where the first wife is disinclined to agree to annulment of the marriage, is it appropriate for the spouses to make a voluntary accord between themselves according to which the wife towards whom the husband feels relatively less attracted voluntarily surrenders some of her rights, prevailing upon her husband not to repudiate the marriage? Would such an act be against the dictates of justice? It is to questions such as these that these verses are addressed. By compromising on their rights, for settlement is better. It is better for the spouses to come to a mutual understanding so that the wife may remain with the same man with whom she has already spent part of her life. Man's soul is always prone to selfishness. The selfishness on the part of the wife is that even though she is conscious of the causes which have contributed to her husband's aversion towards her, she nevertheless expects from him the treatment that a husband accords to the wife that he loves. The selfishness of the husband, on the other hand, lies in suppressing her unduly and curtailing her rights to an intolerable extent merely because she is keen to continue to live with him even though she has lost her attraction for him. Then surely Allah is aware of the things you do. Here too, God urges the male, as he usually does in such matters, to be magnanimous. God urges a man to treat his wife, who has probably spent a considerable number of years with him as his companion, with kindliness and grace in spite of the aversion that he has come to feel for her. He also urges man to love God, for if he were to deprive him of his loving care and blessing in order to punish him for his shortcomings, what place would he have under the sun?
وَلَن تَسْتَطِيعُوا أَن تَعْدِلُوا بَيْنَ النِّسَاءِ وَلَوْ حَرَصْتُمْ فَلَا تَمِيلُوا كُلَّ الْمَيْلِ فَتَذَرُوهَا كَالْمُعَلَّقَةِ وَإِن تُصْلِحُوا وَتَتَّقُوا فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ كَانَ غَفُورًا رَّحِيمًا.
You will not be able to treat your wives with absolute justice, not even when you keenly desire to do so. It suffices in order to follow the law of Allah that you incline not wholly to one, leaving the other in suspense. If you act rightly and remain God-fearing, surely Allah is all-forgiving, all-compassionate. Leaving the other in suspense. This means that it is not possible for a man to accord complete equality of treatment to two or more wives under all circumstances and in all respects. It is possible that one is ugly, the other beautiful, one is old, the other young, one is permanently sick, the other healthy, one is irritable, the other good-tempered. These and other differences are likely to make a person less attracted to one and more to the other. In such circumstances, the law does not demand that one should necessarily maintain absolute equality between the wives in respect of love, emotional attachment, and sexual relationship. What it does demand is that if a husband does not repudiate the marriage despite aversion for his wife, either because of his own desire or out of consideration for the desire of his wife, he should at least maintain a good relationship short of which his wife begins to feel as if she is without a husband. In such circumstances, while it is natural that a person should prefer one wife to the other, this should not go to the extent that the woman remains, as it were, in a state of suspension, as if she were without a husband at all. Some people point out that in this verse, the Quran in one breath stipulates justice as the necessary condition for plurality of wives, and in the other breath declares it to be impossible. On this ground, they conclude that the Quran has itself revoked the permission to marry more than one wife. There is, however, absolutely no justification for such an inference. Such an inference would have been justified had the Quran merely said that you will not be able to treat your wives with absolute justice. But this statement has been followed by the directive, do not allow yourselves to incline wholly to one, leaving the other in suspense. This leaves no grounds at all for the blind followers of Christian Europe to force an interpretation of their liking on the verse. If you act rightly and remain God-fearing, surely Allah is all-forgiving, all-compassionate. If a man does not deliberately inflict any wrong and tries earnestly to be just in his dealings, God will pardon whatever minor shortcoming takes place.
وَإِن يَتَفَرَّقَا يُغْنِ اللَّهُ كُلًّا مِّن سَعَتِهِ وَكَانَ اللَّهُ وَاسِعًا حَكِيمًا
But if the two separate, out of His plenty, Allah will make each dispense with the other. Indeed, Allah is all bounteous, all wise.
وَلِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَقَدْ وَصَّيْنَا الَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْكِتَابَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ وَإِيَّاكُمْ أَنِ اتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَإِنْ تَكْفُرُوا فَإِنَّ لِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَكَانَ اللَّهُ غَنِيًّا حَمِيدًا
All that is in the heavens and all that is in the earth belongs to Allah. We enjoined upon those who were given the book before you, and also yourselves, to have fear of Allah. But if you disbelieve, then bear in mind that all that is in the heavens and all that is in the earth belongs to Allah. Allah is self-sufficient, most praiseworthy.
وَلِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَكَفَى بِاللَّهِ وَكِيلًا
And to Allah belongs all that is in the heavens and all that is in the earth. And Allah suffices for help and protection.
إِن يَشَأْ يُذْهِبْكُمْ أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ وَيَأْتِ بِآخَرِينَ وَكَانَ اللَّهُ عَلَى ذَلِكَ قَدِيرًا
If He wills, He has the full power to remove you, O mankind, and bring in others in your place.
مَنْ كَانَ يُرِيدُ ثَوَابَ الدُّنْيَا فَعِنْدَ اللَّهِ ثَوَابُ الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ وَكَانَ اللَّهُ سَمِيعًا بَصِيرًا
He who desires the reward of this world, let him know that with Allah is the reward of this world and also of the world to come. Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing. Let him know that with Allah is the reward of this world and also of the world to come. Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing. In the Quran, God often rounds off His enunciation of laws by urging people to reform those aspects of family life and social order in which they are generally liable to commit injustice with admonitions designed to create in people the urge to follow those legal injunctions. Since in the preceding verse, the believers were asked to treat women and orphans with justice and kindness, it was deemed necessary to bring home to them the following points. First, that people should not entertain the illusion that they have the power to make or mar the destinies of others, that if they were to withdraw their support, people would be left helpless. The fact is that the destinies of all lie in the hand of God alone, and He need not remain dependent upon any single person as the sole instrument for helping any particular creature. The resources of the Lord of the heavens and the earth are limitless, and He also knows how to use those resources. Second, that the followers of the Prophet, peace be upon him, ought to heed the admonition that was made to them, just as it was made to the followers of the former prophets, to fear God in all their actions. They are being told, in effect, that by following God's guidance, they will secure their own well-being rather than be the source of any benefit to God, that they can do God no harm by disobeying Him, just as it did not lie in the power of the followers of the former prophets to cause God any harm. The Lord of the universe does not need people's obedience. If they disobey, he may simply replace them with some other nation, and their dismissal will not diminish the majesty and splendor of his realm in the least. Third, that God alone has the power to dispense the good of this world as well as that of the hereafter, to lavish transient benefits as well as abiding felicity. It all depends on a man's nature and the extent of his ambition, what kind of benefit he seeks from God. If a man is infatuated with the fleeting benefits of this world and is prepared to sacrifice the benefits of the everlasting life, then God will grant him only the good of this world, and he will have no share in the good of the hereafter. God's benevolence is like a river which never dries up, a river which is both capable of and geared to providing abundant water to all who need their tillage watered. It is short-sighted and unambitious to want one's fields to be irrigated only once and to be prepared thereafter to face the prospect of eternal drought. Anyone with breadth of vision would commit himself to submit to God and obey Him, thereby earning the well-being of both worlds. The section ends with the assertion that God is all-seeing and all-hearing. This means that God is fully aware of the actions of His creatures, and is unlike those negligent sovereigns who are blind in lavishing their favors. God governs the universe with full knowledge and awareness. He has an eye on the capacities and ambitions of all human beings and knows their qualities exactly. He is fully aware of the purposes to which people devote their efforts and energies. Anyone who willfully decides to be disobedient to God should therefore not cherish hopes of receiving the favors reserved for those who obey Him.